Good morning and welcome to Community Voices for this sunny, bright, lovely Thursday morning. Welcome, Pam. Welcome, everyone. We're going to have an interesting conversation with authors of two books about, they both involve guns. One is about gun violence in America and gang violence and ways to quell it. And we have with us a criminologist who has come up with a partial solution. And it's David Kennedy from the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College in New York City. And the name of his book is Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. And then, Pam, in the second half, we're going to talk about soldiers in Afghanistan who shot their way out of a sticky situation.
Yeah, this is Pam Wiley. And the theme for the show is shoot and don't shoot. We'll start with don't shoot. That's David Kennedy. And then we're going to go on to shoot. It's Mitch Weiss and Kevin Maurer, and they're authors of No Way Out, A Story of Valor in the Mountains of Afghanistan. This has been called the Black Hawk Down of Afghanistan, and Weiss is an investigative journalist for Associated Press, won a Pulitzer Prize for covering the Vietnam War, and Maurer has been embedded American troops in Iraq and Haiti and East Africa and Afghanistan.
And so, like six times he's been embedded with special forces in Afghanistan, so he's seen a lot of combat there. And we'll have much to say. So we will be back with David Kennedy in just a moment. And welcome back to Community Voices. And we have on the line with us now David Kennedy, author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. Welcome, Professor Kennedy.
Good morning.
Good to have you on the show. And the reason we invited you on is because you have a new book, and it's because Pam saw you on the Dylan Radigan show and said, wow, this guy has it dialed in. So let's talk. And I should preface this, David, by saying a few weeks ago we had Bill Bratton on, who was police commissioner in Boston, New York City, and police chief in Los Angeles. And he talked some about this, and then we moved on to other subjects. But let's talk about the strategies you have found to quell gang violence and murder. And it sounds like what you've discovered is it's a small minority of gang members who commit the serious violence, and that the solution, a partial solution at least, is to talk to them.
Yep, exactly right.
Okay, end of interview.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so you've actually just named the core of what we found over about 25 years of work, and all the rest of it turns out to be details. But yeah, here's how it works. So even in this time of dramatically improved crime rates for the country, there are still far too many parts of far too many cities where people are literally afraid to go outside and where the homicide rate is fantastically high. And those are almost entirely poor minority communities. And in them, young black men especially are just dying at astronomical rates. And we tend to look at that, and we tell a story about communities. We say these are bad neighborhoods. We say these are troubled families, or otherwise their sons wouldn't be on the street. We look at lots of young men and say, you know, they're bad people. They're at risk. And when you actually get down into the streets and look at what's going on, it turns out to be a vanishingly small number of young men. They are mostly involved, and you called them gangs, and that brings a certain image to mind for people. They're in groups of some kind. They're in drug crews. They're in neighborhood sets. They're in various kinds of usually very informal sets on the street. And those sets will include maybe 5% of the young men in the hottest neighborhoods, and they'll be associated with 75% of all the killing. And because that's true, if you get their attention and change what they're doing, you have a massive impact on serious violence across the entire city. And yes, you talk to them. You can identify these groups. You can identify the people in them. You can literally sit down with them face to face. And what's come to be called the Don't Shoot Work, it goes by various names. It was called Operation Ceasefire in Boston. There are various versions of this. But you sit down with these groups and group members, people they respect in their community, tell them that the community needs the violence to stop. We offer them all kinds of help and social services, and law enforcement says this is not a negotiation. We are putting you on prior notice that the next group that puts a body on the ground in the city is going to draw all of our attention, and everybody in that group is going to get attention for drug sales, outstanding warrants, probation and parole violations, unpaid child support, everything you are doing that's illegal, we will figure out to use as a way to punish the group for the violence. And typically you have one or two of those meetings and the whole area goes dramatically quieter.
How do you identify the people to talk to, and how, I presume it's because they have a pattern of more petty but violent tendencies to crime, and how do you gather them in a room or on a street corner to have that stern talking with them?
So we make a lot of this far more complicated than it needs to be, and the way you identify the groups and the individuals is you go to the frontline police officers and community people in those neighborhoods and say, who are the groups and who are in them? Because these guys are not operating undercover. They stand out. They are very active. Everybody knows who they are. And the way you frame this conversation is you look at those groups, you look at the people in the groups, and because they are such active offenders, it turns out that nearly always at least a couple of people in each group are on probation or parole. They've been convicted of crimes. They're not locked up. They are under what we loosely call supervision. And it means that we can use their court supervised status to require them to come to one of these meetings. And what we say to them is, this is nothing personal. Take what you hear back to your group, and you can talk to an entire neighborhood, sometimes an entire city worth of groups in just a couple of meetings in that way.
You still there?
I'm still here.
Okay. And that way you can talk to them all. And what exactly, what's in it for them? What do they see in it for them?
Yeah, that's the question that often gets asked. And the first and most important question is, nobody should care what's in it for them. We are talking about people shooting other human beings. And the first thing you say to somebody who's likely to shoot another person is, don't do it. This is not a negotiation. It's not a trade. It's not a deal. It is a bright, shining line that nobody should be allowed to cross. But once you've got that straight, and it's important to get it straight, it actually turns out that what's in it for them is that it's their lives that are getting saved, because not only are they much more likely to hurt somebody, they are overwhelmingly likely to be the people that are getting hurt. This kind of violence is mostly within this superheated street population. And we know families in these neighborhoods who are sending their sons to Iraq to be in the army because they are safer in the serving military than they are on their own streets.
Well, that's a sad story in itself. But what you're implementing And what you're seeing success with seems so simple relative to those who propose big picture solutions, which get these kids in school, get them out of poverty, big picture solutions to improve people's lives. You found that just gets everything so complicated that nothing ends up working.
Well, nothing ends up working with respect to this core issue. So the work that we've come up with has the great advantage of being something that ordinary folks can do with ordinary resources, and it will generate big and rapid results. It has the very important disadvantage of being narrow and focused. So I and everybody else concerned about these communities want them to have better schools and for families to be supported and for people to have better health care and more economic opportunity and a long, long list of very important things. But as a practical matter, everybody who has tried to stop this core violence by working on those deeper issues doesn't really get anywhere. It's too big a lift. You require all those changes to be too effective, and you have to make things so perfect that even the 5% of the young men never make it to the point that they're on the streets acting this way, and none of our prevention work in practice is that effective. But the other thing that turns out to be true is that you really can't do the fundamental work of improving communities when young men with guns own the public spaces and people are afraid to go outside and nobody wants to locate a business in these places because it's so scary. If you create a kind of fundamental level of domestic tranquility, then you have a chance to get somewhere on these deeper, longer-term issues.
You got to get the guns out of there first. I mean, you have to at least make the guns silent, right?
That's right.
Okay. So it's enormously pragmatic. Can you give us a couple of stories about where this has worked, some examples?
Sure. So the one that everybody knows best because it was the first and it got the most attention was Boston in the mid-1990s, where we had two of these meetings. And by the first of the meetings was in May of 1996. And by the end of the year, the city had gone almost completely quiet. And when the formal evaluations were done after a couple of years, there had been a nearly two-thirds reduction in youth homicide. We've cooked up a version of this that is about shutting down open-air drug markets where drug dealers in these neighborhoods stand on street corners and run crack houses and things like that. It is, in its way, even more effective. And you can identify the handful of guys who are dealing in that way in these areas and sit them down in this way and have basically the same conversation with them. And neighborhoods that were essentially, free fire zones go quiet that night. And with a little bit of common sense work, you can keep it from ever coming back. They had one of these meetings in Sacramento going on 2 years ago now. And in the worst neighborhood in Sacramento, the last time I got an update, in all the time since, there had been one non-fatal shooting. It's not always that effective, but it can be, and you nearly always get big results out of it.
Do the street cops who've been working gang units for years, are they skeptical when they first are approached about the thought of just gathering the worst of the worst and giving them a stern talking to?
Not so much anymore. This has become pretty well accepted and understood in law enforcement. And the reason that I took the time out to write Don't Shoot, all of this has been well documented in more specialized ways. The academic literature and the theoretical work and the formal evaluations and the deterrence theory behind it and all that kind of thing. But it really hasn't broken out of specialist circles, but law enforcement is one of those specialist circles, and they've been seeing this going on for nearly 20 years now. And they've seen it work. They've heard about it from their peers. They see what happens, and they know that when you get those kinds of changes in a neighborhood, it's not by accident. Something has really happened. And really, our best ambassadors to new cities now are the hard-bitten career cops and community people who've done this. They've seen it. They know it's real, and they are carrying the message nationally now.
How does that make you feel? Pretty good, right?
I wish I could say it did. There is still so much work to do. So we've discovered some very, very important things, and the facts are now very clear that this is, it's nothing like perfect, but it's far better than anything else we've got going. And that's good news. And then you look at how much work there is to do still, and there's a lot of work to do.
Now, this one trend in police work has been community policing, putting little substations in and actually having policemen live in communities that maybe aren't the best or where they would normally want to live. Is community policing part of this, putting cops back on the street and living in these neighborhoods? Does that make them better able to identify the people they need to be talking to? Or is community policing kind of a fad that's going away?
Well, community policing is absolutely not a fad, and it's not going away. But it was never supposed to be about any sort of particular narrow set of tactics. You can build a substation and put cops in the substation and have them do exactly the same thing they were doing when they were at headquarters, and that's not community policing. Community policing is doing things differently. It's not just moving officers around or putting them on bicycles or something like that. And a lot of people looking at this genuinely believe that it's the truest version of community policing that is yet to be seen. And that if we're going to be true to the core values of community policing, then going to elders and mothers and grandmothers and even offenders in a neighborhood and having them say to each other, the community doesn't want this. The community is going to set standards. It's going to enforce those standards. And that even guys who we write off as sociopaths will respect and abide by those community standards. That is community policing.
Okay, now you start your book with the story of Timothy Thomas, a 19-year-old black man, a dad, who ran away from a police officer, and he was shot and killed, and the police officer said he had a gun and he was unarmed.
Yep.
Can you step into the discussion about the killing of Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida? Here's an unarmed black teenager who was killed by a neighborhood watch person. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm going to say what I always say when I'm asked about something where not only I, but I think in a very real way, none of us in this instance know all of the facts. And that is to say, no matter what happened, it is awful and it should not have happened. It was, whatever it was that happened there, was facilitated by a change in self-defense law in Florida and many other places that many of us looked at and said, there is absolutely no way that this is not going to generate the kind of incident that just happened in Florida. This new legal environment in which all you have to do is say, I was scared of him, I was in fear of my life, so I shot him, and the guy's dead and can't speak to his side of what happened, is a recipe for disaster, and we've just seen it happen.
Now, let's go into another area, which is drugs, which are also huge inner city problems. Can you take this principle of just talking to those at the center of violent crime and find the big time drug dealers and just talk to them as well?
Well, let me just take a step back first and say this is not about just talking.
Sure.
It includes communication with people whose behavior we're trying to change, and the idea that we can affect people's lives and behavior while not talking to them, you know, that's pretty silly, and we should never have thought that. But this is not just talk. It's a whole different way of engaging with the problem that includes really resetting communities, law enforcement, social service providers, the streets, everything. But let's take what you just said, and I'm going to be difficult here. So drugs are no more an inner-city problem than they are a suburban problem. Actually, a lot of what we know about this says that there are in many ways more drugs in the suburbs than there are in the inner city. There's more money in the suburbs, so we shouldn't be surprised by that. A lot of those people who have drug problems in the suburbs drive into these urban areas and buy their drugs and cause enormous damage in those neighborhoods, and then they drive back out to their quiet suburban homes and lives. What these communities have is a drug market problem. The way drugs get sold in public spaces, on street corners, from apartments where the idiot white folks can drive them in from the outside and make their connections, that is what is toxic in these neighborhoods. And there are no kingpins, not at that level. You look at the folks who are operating at that street level. They are pathetic, they're broke, they dress badly, they are not making big money. There's a mythology about the life of the drug dealer that is just a cartoon fantasy. And as a matter of fact, yes, you can identify them. There are not very many of them in any neighborhood, in any drug zone. You can find their mother, you can find their grandmother, you can find the elder on the block that they respect. You can do an investigation and get a case on them and dangle that case over their head. And you can then sit them down and say, you need to stop this. Your community needs you to stop it. We would like to help you. And because we've got this case ready to go, you need to understand that if you go back to doing business, we're just going to sign the warrant and go pick you up. And the next time you go at it, we need no new investigations, no new evidence, no new nothing. You are going to jail. And almost everybody stops.
Okay, now I just want to confirm something. Did you say the idiot white folk?
I did.
That's what I thought. The idiot white folk who drive in to buy the drugs.
Look, if you look at what goes on in one of these core urban drug markets, where we love to sit from the outside and talk about how the young men there won't go to work and make bad choices and their families don't control them and all that kind of thing, and then look at who's buying the drugs, it is in every single instance, to a very considerable extent, white folks from outside the neighborhood who drive in and buy drugs and never even get out of their car and drive out again. If you live in a neighborhood, you don't have to stand on the street to sell drugs to your neighbors. The only reason you do that is to sell to people from outside the neighborhood.
No, that's absolutely true, because we have a drug marketplace in Salt Lake called Pioneer Park, and it is it's people with nice cars doing drive-up drug deals through the window. So
absolutely,
and police have been going there for 20 years and busting small-time peddlers, yep. And it continues unabated.
And that's normal. Yep.
And there are 40,000 people dead in Mexico, thanks to the drug problem in America.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Well, not exactly solve that problem, but you are making great progress.
Huge progress.
Talk just briefly, and then we have to end it. I mean, this is all called hot spotting. Describe that concept and how that applies in violent crime.
So hot spotting is a label for a fact that is often true about a lot of very important problems, which is that the lion's share of the problem will be driven by a very small number of people or places or fill in the blank. So I said earlier that in a city that you can look at and say they have a very bad violent crime problem, it's not the city, it's not nearly everybody in the city. It's a few neighborhoods, and then within those neighborhoods, it's a very small number of people. And if you look at the people in those hot neighborhoods who aren't in the gangs and the crews and the drug markets, they're no more at risk than anybody else in the city. It is the tiny subpopulation that's driving this, and that means that across the city, if you deal with the 0.3% of the city's population that is actually part of this problem, you have solved the city's problem.
Okay, very fine. It seems like such a simple solution, and it proves that your work and that of others have proven that it does in fact work. I want to thank you, David Kennedy, for joining us this morning. The book is Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. Thanks for joining us this morning on Community Voices.
Thanks for being interested. I'm really delighted.
Thanks, David.